from an undisclosable location. For reasons of security and therefore ever-escalating insecurity, cometh the hour, cometh the mothership, that is, Coast to Coast AM. Good evening. Delighted to be with you again on Saturday, June the, what is it, the 9th? Oh, yeah. And tonight is going to be one of those nights. It really is. Just a couple of little mentions. Things you already know. Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury has passed away at 91 years old, and I am just grateful that I had the privilege of interviewing him on June 15th, 2007. What an unbelievable visionary. This man predicted everything that we're living now. Well, maybe not all of it, but a lot of it. Fahrenheit 451, the society of that era in the future, sports, seashells, and thimble radios, which bear a striking resemblance to earbuds and Bluetooth headsets and large flat televisions that are common in everybody's house today, and talking to their friends through the digital wall, the same terminology Facebook would use years later for the digital hub that enables friends to post and see images. The loneliness that can come from constantly paying attention to the screens around you rather than the life that's around you. That's a good one. Far ahead of the research and analyses that spawned books on the effects of technology overload, such as Sherry Turkle's Alone Together, Bradbury outlined how he feared that televisions would change the world, and they did. Best propaganda device ever made, would you agree? It's unbelievable. Self-driving, self-thinking cars, which arrest and commit the protagonist to a mental hospital. That'll be next. Oh, you need to be rewired. Oh, dear, your hardwiring is just a step in here, please, to the rewire-a-thon or Tron. Electronic surveillance has popped up in there. He was just an amazing individual. And what's really shocking is if you go back and read Fahrenheit 451, you notice the copyright date is 1950. Tonight is the Fukushima Forum. I was advised by everyone outside Coast Command not to get into this. There's too much information. There's too much disinformation. Don't want to scare anybody. Don't want to scare people. Don't want to panic people. Don't want to make people mad. Why would we make them mad? I have a question for you. What could possibly motivate a nation to build 50 nuclear power plants on a part of the world notorious for large earthquakes? I wonder if there was a profit-driven motive there. Anyway, it makes no difference. Tonight, we'll get into it. Received many emails so far saying you must include this person or your Fukushima spectacular will be incomplete. So I looked at it, and it fit the profile perfectly of someone whose information is not as good as Arne Gunderson's, David Bloom's, Dr. John Apsley, his information, and Dr. Teresa Dale's. So I'll tell you what, we're just going to cut the chatter and get right to our guests. I think that you're going to enjoy the information, if not the subject matter. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. Please stand by. All right, Forum Fukushima, which I was tempted to call something else. I'm not even going to repeat it now. It made Dan Galante laugh. And he said, I know you're going to say that live. I said, maybe, maybe not. Somebody already heard a British descriptive and said, wow, did you really say that on the air? And I did, but I won't repeat that either. All right, you're saying, perhaps, who are these people? You just threw out a bunch of names. Let me tell you about our first guest, Arne Gunderson, 40 years, 40 of nuclear power engineering experience. He attended Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, where he earned his bachelor's degree cum laude while also becoming the recipient of a prestigious Atomic Energy Commission fellowship for his master degree in nuclear engineering. He holds a nuclear safety patent. He was a licensed reactor operator, is a former nuclear industry senior vice president, and during his nuclear power industry career, he's also managed and coordinated projects at 70, count them, 70 power plants in the U.S. Arne Gundersen, welcome to Coast AM. I'm so tired of people not talking about this, so we thought that we would get hold of you, and we are delighted that you are here. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. What a great cast of people you've got tonight.
Well, there are no lawyers between me and this microphone. Therefore, our management at this moment is in deep space. But there's nothing coming out of the mainstream media except for little things like the boxcar-sized dock, 70-foot-long dock, drifted thousands of miles across the Pacific and ended up on an Oregon beach. And the environmentalists are saying, say, it's got little creatures from over there, which could pose a threat to creatures over here. 15 bluefin tunas all were found to have radioactive cesium in them. Now, nobody said whether they were safe to eat or not, but I'm assuming that no cesium is good cesium in one's diet. So tell us where you are on all of this, and perhaps you can enlighten us as to why the entire mainstream media seems to be mum on this subject.
Well, I absolutely agree with you that the mainstream media is mum on the topic. The bluefin tuna is the most frightening information in the recent month or so. That tuna was caught 5 months after the accident. So it was caught in August of last year. Mm-hmm. But the researchers didn't publish it. They wanted to wait until the data was published before they warned us. But that tuna spawned in Japan and then immediately started heading toward the U.S. So it didn't stay in that high radiation field very long, and still when it hit here, you're right, it had both cesium-134 and 137 in it. That means it's a Fukushima signature.
Yes.
And no cesium is good cesium.
Well, so that thing, I did not know that until this moment. It was caught 5 months after the March 11th accident. And we're just now hearing about it.
Right, and it likely only was in the Japanese waters for around a month after the accident. And the last 4 months was swimming across the ocean and growing. So, had it been caught off of Japan, the concentration of cesium would be a lot higher because there's a lot less mass as it swam across the ocean. It ate a little bit more as it came.
Yeah, and one of them that they had tagged, I don't know how they did that or what was the motivation, but apparently it made two round trips in 600 days.
You know, these tuna, they went 15 for 15. Every tuna they caught had cesium. This isn't just a single tuna. They tested 15 and all 15 tested positive. So that basically means that every tuna in the Pacific now is carrying cesium-134 and 137. I think that number is going to go up. I think that the concentrations of cesium are going to grow up over the next couple of years. This is not a one-time occurrence, I don't believe.
And no one has really established any, I mean, I don't know of them, any acceptable levels for radiation-contaminated or radioactively contaminated food, because there's just no way to know. It will affect different people differently. Just there are supposed to be 14, they estimated 14. Now, again, this is a news release from some time ago, but 14,000 extra deaths, human beings 1 year and younger, little kids. So some people will be able to withstand it and others will not. And that's just kind of how it is when you're playing with nuclear radiation, isn't it?
Yeah, there's this thing called linear no threshold. And the more you get, the worse it is. But there is no number below which you're safe. And, I think that's what this tuna has shown us. That first off, it's going up. I'm firmly convinced that when somebody else steps forward now and publishes, we're going to see higher numbers than what was already detected. And second, there is no de minimis number below which you're safe.
Okay, so Well, now there's just been a piece of, the people in Japan are like, don't turn those back on. We just as soon go back to sticks and stones as be wiped out, have the entire nation wiped out by this accident. But I understand the government is saying we're going to have to turn them back on because leaving them off is a society-threatening issue. They are they don't have very many other energy sources, and they're scrambling to get all the what we used to call fossil fuel, all the combustibles that they possibly can now. I mean, they are in pretty serious trouble.
You know, you said it at the beginning of the hour. You know, they put 54 nuclear units in likely the worst location in the world as far as, you know, earthquakes go, tsunamis go. You know, I was in Japan. I wrote a book in Japanese on the book tour, and the plants are built right on the ocean, and right behind them, mountains just take right off. There's very little habitable land in Japan, and so you've got high concentrations of people, high concentrations of earthquakes, and high concentrations of nuclear plants, and they just don't go together. So I can understand where the Japanese are really concerned about starting these things back up again. It's interesting because it's being led by mothers, which, you know, women, which traditionally in the Japanese culture this is a unique experience that women are stepping up and saying, you know, hell no, we won't blow. It's a real change politically.
We were going to have, Arnie, we were going to have a nuclear engineering professor. He's in the University of California system. I must not say his name, nor which of the universities in California, because it's a pretty big system, but whichever one it is, they study nuclear engineering. You can narrow it from there. And he was very reticent to at first, and then I thought, I don't think he's going to do it. So a friend of mine who made this introduction, He eventually said, well, first it was graduation, then he was going to be traveling, and then it was like, nah, I think I'm going to have to bow out of this one. How much pressure do you think is on the professional community, whether it's in academia or whether it is in the actual nuclear industry, to keep quiet? How many billions of dollars are at stake if the people decide we don't want this, turn it off?
Yeah, you know, there's an enormous amount of money that's going into the educational facilities like MIT. MIT has a Tokyo Electric endowed chair on their nuclear faculty. You know, so there's just one example of how pervasive money is. I've been working with researchers who are doing great science. This is not crazy science. This is great science, and they're having an extraordinary difficult time getting their articles published. Again, because of industry pressure to downplay the significance of this event, there's trillions of dollars at stake, and whether it's the United States Congress, which is putting enormous pressure on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission not to make these plants in the U.S. any safer, you know, in Japan it's similar. There's an enormous amount of pressure to get these plants started up before the safety modifications are put in place. It's truly a group of populists versus an enormous amount of money. And I think the jury's still out on who's going to win the struggle in the United States and in Japan. I mean, you know, Europe is, the Germans have decided not to, the Italians have decided not to. There's like a domino effect going on in Europe where people are walking away from nuclear. In Japan and in the United States, there's an awful lot of money on the line, and I think it's going to be a long march.
Now, the way a nuclear power plant works, I mean, do I have this sort of right? You control the heat of the reactor. You get yourself a water source, flow the water over the rods, turn it into steam. Steam turns the turbines, which turn the generators or alternators, whatever they might be, and out goes the power. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, you know, but the heat, you know, when you hear a nuclear plant safely shuts down, what that means is that the nuclear control rods fall into the nuclear reactor and stop the chain reaction. But about 5% of the heat never goes away. And that's the problem with this is that once a uranium atom splits, you only get 95% of the heat from the actual fission. But 5% hangs around in the heat that's generated from all these radioactive pieces.
And how much heat is that, Arnie?
Oh, it's enormous. Like, you know, 5% doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, Fukushima was, each of the Daiichi units were about 3 million horsepower. So 5% of that is 150,000 horsepower. You know, think about diesel, diesel trucks. They're maybe 500 horsepower, 1,000 horsepower when they're running flat out. So you've got hundreds of diesel trucks worth of heat that has to be gotten rid of. And if you don't do that well, it really doesn't matter if the control rods have fallen in or not. You're going to have a meltdown.
What are these control rods made of?
They're made of boron. Boron is really good at absorbing neutrons. They have a cladding on the outside, but really it's nothing like but 20 muon borax. It's a boron and it's a sponge for neutrons and prevents the chain reaction from going on.
So the science has really not changed since Oppenheimer. I mean, this is still old school stuff. It's just the gear looks prettier.
And actually, most of the reactors in the United States were built before 1980, and the same in Japan. So not only is it old technology, but they're old reactors. So the average reactor in the United States is 30 years old, as in Japan. We're dealing with equipment now that's starting to show its age, on top of a technology that really hasn't changed in the last 80 years.
You know, this physicist that I mentioned earlier, who shall remain nameless because we could get him in trouble, and I don't want to do that. He would be on the show, except he's not like you or me, and he's probably got a lot of pressure. But the spent fuel rods over there, spent means what? They become at what percentage of radioactivity do they have to drop before they're considered spent? Because they're still hot.
Yeah, actually, a new fuel rod is hardly radioactive. And as they become spent, they become more radioactive because they pick up the uranium splits, and the pieces that it splits into are a lot more radioactive than the uranium from which it came. So a spent fuel rod can have just an astronomical amount of radiation. The amount of radiation in the fuel pool at Fukushima Unit 4 is roughly equal to all of the cesium that was exploded in all of the 700 above ground nuclear tests that we did in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So a spent fuel pool actually means it's highly radioactive and contains an enormous inventory of radioactive, what we call radioactive daughter products.
And so what do we do with our spent rods?
Boy, that's a great question. I think if the United States could answer that question, they would we'd be on a path to more nuclear power plants. There's an interesting court case that just came out yesterday. Where an appellate court in New York City determined that we don't have a plan. Basically, they threw the NRC's policies back and said, you don't have a plan to store this nuclear fuel. Go back and do it over again. Right now, we're sticking it in these pools. And let's look at Fukushima Daiichi as an example. There are 7 stories in the air. And very heavy, so it's almost like putting a swimming pool on top of a hotel. You know, it's not exactly the ideal place for a large mass like that. So what happens is that the pool contains an enormous amount of radioactivity, and we're keeping it up there because it's cheap. The best thing to do would be to put it into dry casks, which means you take it out of the water and you put it in these heavily shielded. They weigh about over 100 tons. Then you'd set them on the ground where they're a lot less resistant to earthquakes and tsunamis. Fukushima had some dry casks, and they survived just fine. But it's all the fuel that's sitting in these fuel pools that is a worldwide concern. And actually, the plants in the United States are probably 4 or 5 times worse than that as far as the amount of nuclear waste that's stored in their fuel pools.
Well, I have a bunch of questions to ask you, and we're down to about, I don't know, maybe a minute. But very, very quickly, because I don't want the thing to cut you off, what is reprocessing?
Well, the plan is that reprocessing would strip out the plutonium that's generated, and that could be reburned in another generation of power plants.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't want you to have to give short answers, so just to make sure everybody stays awake tonight, because this is a little bit of a classroom, when they start throwing the terms at us, reprocessing and blah, 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 at least we'll know what they're talking about, because I don't think they do. This is the one, that's just me, I don't think they do. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. We shall continue with our Fukushima Forum for this Saturday night. I'm not happy that these fish are contaminated. And the cold streets we roam that are in the lyric there, if I were going to be fanciful and go pre-geriatric hippie, I would say the cold streets that we roam all have exactly the same thing written on their street signs. Ignorance. So we admire those who adapt and overcome in the stories that we read and the movies that we watch. But maybe what's on the screen and what's happening in our lives have somehow merged, which means we're going to have to cowboy and cowgirl up and take responsibility for ourselves and for our communities. And the first step is fear nothing. The second step is educate yourselves, educate ourselves, and educate each other. And that's what we're doing tonight, the Fukushima Forum. Renamed from Cluster Fukushima, because that's pretty much, well, there it is. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM. In 2 minutes, we'll be back with Arne Gunderson. Arne Gunderson is with us for this hour. And I wanted to ask you, is it your opinion that any of this debris making landfall now might not be radioactive? Is there a chance any of this stuff is hot? Or is it pretty much washed away over a long trip across the Pacific?
I'm sure some of it will be radioactive. You got to remember that the tsunami knocked out over 100 miles of coast, and the tsunami happened before the meltdown. So a lot of that rubble was heading out to sea before the plants exploded. But the material that was close to Fukushima, within 10 or so miles from Fukushima, maybe even 20. Got contaminated, and of course it had a long bath as it worked its way across the Pacific. We had an aircraft carrier 100 miles offshore, and it actually contaminated the deck of the Ronald Reagan 100 miles offshore. So clearly the material got in the ocean. The question is, over a year at sea, It's washed off or not. It started out contaminated, and I'm sure we'll find some in the nooks and crannies of the material when it hits the West Coast.
You know, this is just. I expect if you deign to answer this question, it will be purely conjecture. But just a couple of guys talking here with a few million of our closest friends. Does that seem like a naturally induced tsunami? Because if there's one thing I can't stand, it's like, it was the Zionists did it. They let off a nuke in the ocean. It's like, I don't know if they did or not. I really don't. But it does seem like an earthquake that size would have caused more structural damage to the various man-made structures. So have you given any thought to what actually caused that thing? Does anything about this look funny to you or not really? Is it just a natural disaster and there was a reactor in the way?
Well, I know a bunch of geologists, and the Richter 9 plus was out at sea. By the time it got to the plant, it was about a 7.5, and the plant was designed for a 7.5. So that the earthquake didn't cause these plants to turn into absolute rubble is it doesn't surprise me. The real problem is I don't need a conspiracy to leave my head shaken, because we did this to ourselves. There is plenty of evidence on the record that over the last 2,000 years, there's been four of these tsunamis of this size that have nailed that part of Japan. We, as a civilization on the planet, you know, the American engineers who built this plant, had ample geologic data to indicate that, hey, every 500-600 years, a tsunami of this size hits, and we didn't design against it. So I don't need a conspiracy to get angry at mankind for watching dollars as opposed to watching safety. And I think that's really what happened at Fukushima.
Let me ask you something. Somebody wanted to ask: Are you still active in the design phase of any of the new reactors, or have you shifted out of that?
I'm active on one reactor design, the AP1000, which is the one that's going to be built down in South Carolina. But I've been paying attention to the old reactors. So we got 100 old reactors in this country that, like me, are should be nearing retirement.
And now, is this new one that you're working on? Is it the fourth generation reactor?
Yeah. Yeah, it's called AP for Advanced Passive, and it's built by Westinghouse, a U.S. firm, and Toshiba, a Japanese firm. It's interesting because people knew that a loss of offsite power was the most likely cause of an accident, which is what happened at Fukushima, and this plant was built to withstand that. But you know, engineers make trade-offs. So to make a plant that doesn't need electricity, they made a plant that's seismically much weaker than the plants we've got in Japan. So Westinghouse Toshiba will be out there saying that this new design could have withstood the tsunami. And they're right. But the problem is it wouldn't have withstood the earthquake. In the trade-offs that go into building plants, you pick up some benefit, but you lose some robustness as well.
Worst case scenario, of course, would be if reactor number four gets hit with another one, and it's if you look on a little earthquake map, you'll see that there are little rumbles just occurring all the time over there. It's all the time. China syndrome. What is China syndrome?
Yeah. I'd like to talk about that worst-case scenario.
Take them in order.
Yeah, we've had two close calls already on the Fukushima Daiichi accident. You recall that the Americans withdrew out beyond 50 miles at the beginning of the accident because they were worried about the Unit 4 fuel pool. But in addition, when the tsunami hit the coast of Japan, it knocked out the diesel generators, not just at Fukushima Daiichi, but at 14 other nuclear plants up and down the coast. So those 14 plants had 37 diesels, 24 of which were knocked out. So we almost had a situation where we had 15 meltdowns and not three. Some very heroic Japanese men risked their lives to prevent that. So now we're talking about Unit 4 again, because structurally it's weak and it has an enormous amount of radioactive material in it. And another Richter 7 or more earthquake will likely either crack that fuel pool or topple the building. In which case, the fuel is hot enough still to burn in air. It can ignite. The metal that the nuclear fuel is made from can ignite. Now, Brookhaven National Labs has done a study that shows that a fuel pool that's a lot less full than Fukushima, in the case of a fuel pool fire, because 186,000 fatalities. So we're looking at the possibility. God help us if we have another earthquake. But you know, like you said, it's Japan and it's happening all the time. If they have a Richter 7 or greater, it's likely that we'll get either a damaged pool or a collapsed building. But the Tokyo Electric has acknowledged that the building has a bulge in the side of it as a result of the previous tsunami and earthquake. So it's a weakened building, and we're in a race against time. We either empty that fuel pool as quickly as we possibly can, get it down on the ground as in dry casks, before the next earthquake comes.
And back to that China syndrome thing, is this where the material burns down to the groundwater?
Yeah, the China syndrome happens from the chain reaction is stopped. The nuclear chain reaction stops almost immediately when the nuclear fuel rods come in. But there's all that decay heat from these daughter products. If you don't get a China syndrome in the first month, you're not going to get one. So the plant has been cooled long enough that there's still a lot of heat, but not enough to melt into bedrock.
Okay, good.
Well, the good news is it won't go down. The bad news is it'll go up as flame and smoke. So, but the concept of a molten blob melting into bedrock is behind us. We all knew that in the industry they were in a race against time, and they were risking workers and pouring salt water on the nuclear reactor when really that's not a good thing to do. But the alternative would be to get that China syndrome that you were just talking about. And that would have been worse than salt water or worker exposures or anything. So they made the right choice.
Now, you mentioned that our reactors are 30-something years old, maybe even a little older. What sort of a position are we in? We have earthquakes here sometime. I understand some of these reactors are sitting near fault lines across the country. Only takes a couple of them to get cracked, and there's a problem. So are you aware of any plan to revamp or recondition these plants, or are we just going to, see how it works out?
There's 27 nuclear reactors that are that the NRC has known for over 10 years. Are in jeopardy from earthquake issues, and they're not on the West Coast; they're on the East Coast. We underdesigned our nuclear plants on the East Coast because we really didn't understand seismic issues back in the '60s when these plants were being built. The worst plant in the country, as far as seismic risk, I guess, is Indian Point, which is only 25 miles outside of New York. It was underdesigned, and again, as we're going on and learning more about, oh my God, there's a fault just a couple miles north of the plant that they didn't know about when they built it. But anyway, there's 27 East Coast plants that are reevaluating their seismic design. Now, what that means is that they'll put extra shock absorbers, just like in your car, but huge, in the plant to try to prevent these pipes from swaying too much. But what will happen, though, is that to revamp a plant is very expensive. And these plants are quite old. So my guess is that when it gets to the point where the NRC says, fix it, a lot of these plants will say it's cheaper to shut them down than it is to make these necessary repairs.
Well, two-part question. Number one. Or Roman numeral one, because there aren't any additional letters under it. Is nuclear energy a good idea? And second, what, in your opinion, is the future of nuclear energy in this country?
My career is, like you said, 40 years, and I started out with high hopes for nuclear and actually believed the system worked. In 1990, I became a nuclear whistleblower, and I no longer trusted the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but I still believed in nuclear power. And even a month before Fukushima, I was out there saying to people, we should never build coal or oil because of global warming. We should focus on renewables. And like your next guest, on on alcohol and renewable fuels. We can do it other ways. But if that's not enough, we should still build nuclear. But what Fukushima taught me is that we as a species are not smart enough to defend against what Mother Nature can throw at us. Or what terrorists can throw at us. That might be the next accident. It might not be Mother Nature. It might be terrorists. So my conclusion, my personal conclusion, is very similar to Mikhail Gorbachev in his memoirs. Says that it wasn't Perestroika that destroyed the Soviet Union. It was Chernobyl. So we're dealing with a technology that can destroy a nation. Is it really worth the risk? The second half of your question about nuclear looking forward, we wouldn't have nuclear. There's four new nuclear plants being built in the South. They would not be built if the economics were being considered. Wall Street won't touch them, but we've got enormous federal loan guarantees. So all of us nationwide are ponying up loan guarantees to get these plants built because, in fact, they don't make any economic sense.
Oh, yeah, so somebody clever in the political arena will say, well, it was taxpayer money, with that look on their face, like, we, the people, approved this. It's extraordinary to me.
I testified down in South Carolina on the two nukes down there, and they said, you know, you're a Yankee. Why don't you just stay home? This is our plan. And I said to him, you know, you're absolutely right. I'll gladly stay home and not talk about safety, but don't ask for me to guarantee your loan. It works both ways.
Mm-hmm. Why, in your opinion, has the entire world not come to Japan's aid? Surely there must be some smart guys out there that can figure out some sort of cover to put on this thing, something?
I think that Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government are reticent to step up and really ask for help. I've known some experts who've gone over there with great ideas, and not just ideas, great techniques that work. And they've been told by Tokyo Electric and the Japanese that you're an American firm. We're not going to give this work to you. We're gonna figure out a way ourselves. So whether it's national pride or the fact that Tokyo Electric is essentially bankrupt and can't afford it. In any event, all those things are conspiring to slow this process down. You're right. There are a lot of ideas, and there are a lot of talented people who would like to step into this void. And Tokyo Electric and the Japanese government are just not willing or capable of asking for help.
I got a feeling it goes back to that ancient face-saving thing.
Yes.
You know?
I think you're right. This is... it shouldn't be, because these are an American design.
Seriously.
FEMA 1, 2, 3, and 4 were identical to plants that I worked on here on the East Coast, Millstone 1, Pilgrim, et cetera. So it's not as if the Japanese were marching to a different drummer back in the 70s when these plants were built, but I think you're right. Part of it is saving face.
Well, I've used this term already once tonight, the pre-geriatric hippie thing, but it's too bad that somebody, some actual statesman, couldn't approach that government and say, look, you know, if you think about it, we're partially responsible for this because we made the demand and you came up with the products. You're a small country and you've put out cars and electronics and all kinds of things and just had a booming economy and then started having problems. And so now you got a problem and we're willing to help. You know, we enjoyed the proceeds from the fruits of your labors, and now you have trouble. Let us help you. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, where is the global compassion for a nation? This could result if that number four goes down and we go to a worst case scenario, we could have 125 million refugees. They've actually even talked about evacuating the entire country. So,
no, you're absolutely right. We had the world was more willing to step forward after Chernobyl, perhaps because it was right in the middle of Europe. But it seems like the Japanese are left to do it themselves. The cost of this is going to be something on the order of a half a trillion dollars. that, and of course, Japan is a lot smaller country to carry that. I mean, we seem to have run deficits of that amount every year. But
right.
on top of the Japanese deficit, over the next 20 years, they're going to have to raise their electric rates to pay for this, because there's nobody stepping up to give them $500 billion.
Yes.
The money they saved in oil over
right.
40 years, they lost.
Oh, yeah, big time, exponentially. We got to go. Arnie, thank you so much for being with us. It was a pleasure to have you as a first-time guest. Fairwinds.org, F-A-I-R-E-Winds.org, fairwinds.org. That's Arnie Gunderson. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back with David Blum.